Welcome to Once Upon a Film Industry. I'm Stephen Lloyd Bennett.
And I'm Al Lopez.
And we are here today with Miss Nell Tier. How you doing, Nell?
I'm great. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you. We've heard good things, and we're just going to learn more about Nell Tier and the world of Nell Tier. Nell Tier is a filmmaker, actress, director, producer. What else do you do now? Do you do other things?
Book writer, right?
Book writer.
Yes.
Writer.
Yeah. I'm an Aunt Nellie.
So just to kick it off, where are you from and what got you started in the industry?
Yeah. I grew up in Houston, Texas, born and raised there. My mother was an actress. My mom was actually one of the original Dean Martin gold diggers on the Dean Martin show in the 60s out here in LA. She toured through Vietnam with Bob Hope and Anne Margaret, and then went back to Houston and started working on the stage there regionally. And when I came along, and my brother and sister and I, we just sort of became, you know, the kids of the green room, so to speak. So I grew up in a theater. We moved to our blueberry farm in the 80s, which was small town Huntsville, Texas. And my mom went back and got her degree at a university there, Sam Houston State University. And then we really did just live in a green room, in a university green room. So it was very educational. So I was like, you know, homework in the green room, playing dress up in the costume shop, you know, running around the entirety of the theater, watching my mother be directed, which was really interesting. But at that point, I was very, very sure that my trajectory was to be an actress. My mom was my idol. I grew up, you know, that was what we did. The theater was our great love together. And I went to a magnet middle school in Houston for theater, Pershing Middle School. And then I went to the High School for Performing and Visual Arts in Houston to study theater. Justin Simeon went there. Courtney Sauls, Beyonce was there for a year. It's a really great school. It was just amazing. You're surrounded by art. It was academically very, very competitive. And I loved it. I was talking to a friend of mine, Reggie Quinterly, actually, who was in the jazz program there. And we were so insulated. We had just kind of this bubble where we all just got to love each other, regardless of who we were, or what color we were, or what we believed in. And so it was a really wonderful way to grow up, like those teen years. And then I left and I went to NYU and I studied musical theater at Tisch School of the Arts.
Nice.
Yeah, my junior year there, I left school, went to Boston, did the original production of Memphis. I was like the teenage track. And then it took 10 years for it to go to Broadway, and I could no longer play a 15-year-old. So that was sad. But Memphis went on to win the Tony in 2010, which is really, really cool. And in New York, I kind of lost my way a little bit. I fell in love and got married and kind of let myself down and wasn't really focused on my career. And then when the marriage fell apart, I moved to LA in 2010. And I picked up where I left off. I did a show called Harps and Angels, which was Randy Newman's musical, at the Taper with Michael McKean and Katie Segal, some amazing people. And I came in as one of the sort of the covers or the understudies. And I kind of got my feet wet again out in LA. And then the next year, my mom passed away.
Oh.
And then all of a sudden, I just had this big shift and I had kind of this space inside me that I had never thought that I would do anything other than be an actor. Not really. I mean, sometimes I was like, maybe I should just be an attorney.
right.
But when she passed, I realized that, she was a horrible alcoholic, very tumultuous childhood. She and my brother were estranged for over a decade. I mean, it was just a really, really rough childhood and rough relationship with her. And it was really, really heartbreaking because she was so magical and talented. And I realized that sort of throughout my career, I was wanting to be an extension of her, to sort of prove her lovability by my lovability and to prove how successful she could have been by how successful I could be. And so when she passed away, I got all this energy back that I didn't know what to do with, you know, it was just sort of my own. And I started painting, not well, but I started painting. And then I got asked to direct a one-woman show and I shot a little documentary to go with it. And I was hooked. And that was 2012. 2013, I enrolled in a course called The Art of Visual Storytelling with Miles Botkins. I made three films on my own in the course, you know, wrote, directed. And use that kind of as a reel. And I started directing scenes for actor friends. And then I fell into this job of directing commercial book trailers at Film 14, which I still work with Adam Cushman and his amazing company. And I think I've directed something like 80 book trailers at this point. I mean, I'm getting up there, and there's some that I like will have flashes of like, oh God, like it's a bad night of drinking that you don't remember. And you're like, oh my God, I did do that book trailer. Oh my God. You know what I mean? Like five years ago. Right. And then that turned into this strange career I've had for the past like 7 years of directing everybody else's stuff. So I would get reached out to by producers and screenwriters and actors who wanted me to direct their projects. And so, you know, it's like 20 short films later and some pilot presentations and music videos and all sorts of stuff. And I look back at that and I'm like over 100 and something projects at this point. And none of them.
That's insane.
It's insane. And none of them.
It's unbelievable.
None of them were mine except for the first three.
Right.
So that's the other kind of crazy thing until this year, until the pandemic hit and I had time to stop and I didn't have a choice but to say no to some of these things. Or, well, no one was doing anything. And so I finished a feature. I finished writing a feature in March. We cast it in May. We raised the funds over the summer and finished principal photography on October 9th. And I've just now seen the first assembly as of a couple days ago. This one's really special because my mom, when we were little, her dream was that my siblings and her and I, whatever that grammar is, would all be in films together. That was her dream. And there's a flashback sequence in this film where we meet the family younger. And I cast my brother as the dad and my sister as the mom. There's no kissy behavior or anything like that. Right, and then a niece and a nephew. My niece plays the younger of my characters. I also star in this. And my nephew plays the younger of the Sunny character.
Nice.
So all these years later, my debut feature is my mom's dream realized posthumously. So
during a pandemic.
During a pandemic.
Wow.
I like to keep it interesting.
We know the whole story of Neltier right now.
Yeah, that
I thought that was the question.
That was great. That was great. Yeah. So you did your when did you film your first film? When did you start filming it?
We shot the flashback portion with my family.
Yeah.
Down on the Texas coast in June.
Okay.
And we shot everything on film. I'm a film junkie. So all the flashbacks are 16 millimeter and all the present day stuff is 35 millimeter. So
it's really
beautiful.
Yeah. Okay. Let's unpack this for a second. Because this is 2020 and she's shooting on film. And I don't think people who are getting into this know the tediousness. I've never shot on film before. I've always heard stories and I've seen people before.
Absolutely should.
I've heard that many times and I feel like maybe I should.
Yes.
But let the people know the process of shooting on film, what that's like.
It's a little bit scary, obviously, because, well, you know what it is? It's all about preparation, right? So you have to know what you want to capture. You have to work that out with your team and with your actors. So there's kind of a theatrical element to it because there's a lot of rehearsal and there's blocking and because seconds are dollars, right? I mean, you're paying for this thing that is a living thing. It's like an organic thing, right? I think that's one of the reasons I love it so much is because you're never going to get the same thing twice. You know, I mean, even if the light is the same and all of that, it's always going to be different if something shifts or something moves. I mean, you know, you have like little specks in there and things. And I mean, technically you can talk to my DP, Julia Swain, more about all of that. But what I know is that I love that we're really capturing a moment, like the ephemeral aspect of life. And I love that because, you know, these seconds and then they're gone. Right. These moments are just here and then they're gone. And I always loved that about theater. that, you know, you have an experience with an audience on stage with your fellow actors. You can never recreate that. You can't go right. back.
Right.
So I love that about film. It's also very scary. And, you know, like things right. on set can just ruin it. If something, you know, messes with it, if there's like a hair in there or whatever, I mean, it's all very technical. And I think it's just the financial aspect of it. You know, you can shoot a ton of it, but if you screw it up, you're...
Yeah, so when you say seconds is dollars, so people who are just getting to this know, what does that mean when you say seconds are dollars? Why is it so expensive?
Well, you know, with digital, you're not paying for how you capture it, basically, right? You can let that thing run and then you can just cut it and delete it. It doesn't matter, right? But with film, you know, you have a tangible thing. You have a finite amount of space in which to capture your story. And you pay for that. So you're not just renting a camera, you're also renting film. Mm. I mean, buying film and right. exposing it. And so it raises the stakes, but I think ultimately it raises the stakes in a way that is conducive to having a more efficient set, right? Because the minute you hear action,
game time,
and you can't, and you know, and that's that. And when you hear cut, it's cut. Like you don't get to just sort of fish around afterwards and maybe capture some of these little lovely things that we know we've all used to like splice into our performers' performances.
Right.
You know, you don't have that. So, I mean, it's immediate. Go on.
What made you choose film as opposed to the digital way?
Well, it's interesting. I had never shot on film. I'd made something like 60 something projects. I guess this is 2017, maybe January 2016. I can't remember when. They kind of blend together. But around that time, I was hired to direct a beautiful short film called Always Remember Me, which we actually just found out is going to have its online premiere with Amuleto, which is really exciting.
Oh, nice.
It had a great festival run. We won Key West. It's a really special little movie, and it's about a family who is stuck in a certain period in their life where something tragic happened and they kind of can't get out of it, right? It's in the 90s. And so I thought and talked to my DP and talked to the executive producer who was also starring in it and had it commissioned to be written. And it was kind of like, I think we need to shoot this on film. Cause you know, when you watch one of those old movies
right. And
it like transports you immediately. And yes, right. There's tons of LUTs and things that you can do. And all of that science is amazing and brilliant.
Right.
But there's something about it that just feels so different, so romantic, right, to me. And so I shot on film for the first time with that on 16mm, and I was like absolutely hooked because of what I was telling you guys about how I feel about theater and, you know, the ephemeral aspect of life. And like all of that in my romantic, ridiculous brain was just swirling. And then as fate would have it, I was up at Sundance right after we shot this, because I think we shot it right around Christmas. It must have been December or something. And I met Steve Bellamy, who is the president of motion picture at Kodak. And if you if you have not met Steve Bellamy, put it on your to-do list, because he is absolutely fantastic and he is a film nut and he loves it. And so we got to talking about it and we had a meeting and he sort of adopted me into this film fraternity and people that I know and love now and have known them for years. And I've made a commitment as a filmmaker to, as often as I can, and if the project calls for it, to shoot on film. And I love it. And so we shot another one, Pappy Hour, on 35, fell in love with 35. It's so beautiful. And then in this one, because the memories are sort of plaguing our character's waking life. It's her experience of grief, which really kind of happens of this, like, she can't stop thinking these memories. They're just with her all day long. I thought, how beautiful to have a little bit more texture to the memory than the present day stuff. So that's why we chose to go with both 16 and 35.
Nice. So tell us about the movie. What's the story? What's the inspiration behind it?
So Sunny is the name of it. And Sonny is the little brother of Maggie. The family are the McDades. About 6.5 years ago, a friend of mine, James Walsh, and I had an idea to make a short film where we played brother and sister because we kind of look alike. And then it never sort of came to fruition. But I took kind of ideas from that. And then I applied my loss of my mother and the way I experienced grief. And it just all sort of swirled together. And I like vomited this movie out. Right. Pardon for the disgusting idea. But I mean, like I wrote it in 3 weeks and it was... Right. It was just one of those things where I was able to take so many of my experiences and I split my mom in life. I split her up into two characters, the brother character and the mom character. And because when you lose an addict, you sort of lose both parts of them. You lose like the parts that you love so much. Right. You usually lose those things while they're still here. And then when they die, you lose the addict. So there's a mourning period that's just extended a lot of times.
Right.
So anyway, that sort of inspired it. But basically we meet Maggie in the midst of her grief and her life is kind of falling apart. And it's that aspect of humanity that's so sad where, you know, we oftentimes become the tragedy when tragedy hits and sometimes we don't. And so we're kind of with her navigating that, walking that tightrope of, is she going to be okay? Is she not going to be okay?
Right. And this is a drama, I'm assuming. This is not... Yeah, very
not
much
a comedy.
Right.
Not a comedy. I think there's breath in there. I mean, we'll see after the final edit. I've just seen the assembly, but there's some moments there, you know, she kind of gets her head above water for a second. And I think in the end, it's life affirming, you know?
Nice. So. Nice. On set, what was it? What was the COVID security like? Did you guys...
Oh, man.
How did that work out?
Yeah. Well, we had a very, very safe set. So Robert Pine stars as my dad in this, and Robert is 79 years old, and so we were very, very, we were on high alert for all of us, but especially for that. Right. And my God, I had the best team in the whole freaking world. My producing partner, Jerry Cope, and I were from the beginning very, very specific about how stringent these things would be. So we devoured all of the network and studio models for their zoning and for how we would do it. And I just remember when we had our SAG call, it was me and Jerry and Elizabeth Mihelich, my amazing line producer. We turned this thing in. We had, you know, our HSM was Cutter, this guy Cutter, who's great. And then we had Keller, who was like on set with us. And we laughed because he would like peek around the corner and be like, pull your mask up. Like anywhere you would be like, you're too close.
I'm sorry, time out. What's HSM for the audience?
Yes, health safety manager. Yeah, I think that's right. Right. But basically you have to submit to SAG your whole plan. And everything that you're going to do. And I mean, we did not do rapid testing because those are not reliable. We spent the money and did we spent a lot of money on PCR tests for everyone. Every third day, I think, is what we ended up doing. And then for every day before an actor would come to set. And if there was an intimate scene or like a kissing situation, then you would get tested the day before and the day of. All the PCR tests. So, and those days were terrifying because you're sitting there like, oh God, is anybody sick? And we were only like 30 people, 32 people on our busiest day. You know, if someone was to get sick, I mean, that would be lights out for us.
Right.
So we were very, very, very careful.
Right.
But yeah.
How was the process of raising the funds, if you want to divulge?
Jerry Cope is amazing. And, you know, he believes in this work. And he believed in me from the minute we met. And he's read a bunch of my stuff. And we just kind of came together. But Jerry, you know, Jerry has been in the environmental world for a long time, a lot of documentary, a lot of music. He's an old liberal Texan who spent most of his life in Colorado. And he's just the best thing in the world. And he really helped me in that way. I mean, I'm definitely good at like getting people excited about stuff. And I certainly have so many ideas that I like fall over them throughout the day. But it was really great to have somebody who knew where to go. Like I raised a portion of it up front so that we could shoot the Texas stuff, because I knew that was really important to kind of have to show what the look of this would be.
Right.
So I did that, and then he really came in and kind of took charge on the rest of that. And it was just a lot of financial documents, a lot of back and forth, a lot of finding people who kind of got the story and wanted to be a part of it.
Nice.
You know, and yeah. So, I mean, that was really the process. I think that's kind of always the process, is like, you have to find investors who are passionate about who you are as an artist, yeah, what stories you're telling, you know?
Right.
And would you say, I mean, just for our listeners can understand this, when you say you funded the first portion of it in Texas, was that, did you create a trailer for it and then shop around so you can get funded for the rest of the movie, or how did that work?
No, not really. I mean, we used some stills and we used portions of, you know, the flashback stuff.
Okay.
To just kind of help people who were already on board, like
jump over
that extra. Yeah.
Exactly. Get over the hurdle.
Yeah. But that was never really it was kind of funny because I was not even intending that, but that was Jerry's idea. He's like, you know, if we show people this, and I said, okay. So we did.
Nice. Mm. What is your process? That's what I wanted to know. When you've done so many projects, what is your process when you're prepping for a new project, or is it the same going through for each one, or different for each one?
With the films that I get hired to do, they'll send me the script. They'll give me an idea of what the budget is. And then I try to figure out what I'm going to be able to do to meet that budget. I mean, I think in the independent world, that's the hardest part. I shot a pilot presentation in 3 days. We were shooting between 9 and 12 pages a day on some days.
Wow.
And that was because budget wise, we could really only afford to do 3 days,
right,
you know, with what they had. And we got it done. And I think that's kind of where my mind goes. I like having parameters within which to work, because my brain gets creative in that way. You know, if you were to give me just like unlimited funds, unlimited locations, I mean, I might just get lost. Like I would just go off into the universe and never come back.
So you act, you direct. Which one is more fun?
Really? The directing is more fun, yeah, for sure. I think when I was ready to make that switch, even before my mom died, I was starting to do some like co-stars, television, and you know, that kind of thing, which is very different from theater. You know, theater, you're included all day. You're like on stage. You have so much to do.
Right.
And on set, sometimes the actors and they're just expected to like turn it on instantly.
Yeah.
But then they have to go sit and wait. You know, I mean, it's just an unbelievable Herculean effort, you know,
right.
As an actor. And I hadn't been acting at all. And a woman that I mentored, who is now just like amazing, she wrote and directed a short film called Hot Water. And I play the lead in that. I just remember being so tired, and I never get tired when I'm directing. I mean, like I feel like I could just go and go and go. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the back and forth of like waiting and then having to turn it on and then waiting and then having to turn it on, you know?
Yeah. So I agree.
Definitely directing.
Yeah. I feel like when I'm directing, it's like once the day starts, really not even the day. Once I wake up in the morning of the day of a shoot, it's like I jump on a roller coaster. And I just on this adrenaline high, just driving to set. I'm on adrenaline high.
Ready?
Yeah. Yeah, just super hyped. And then like, I try to keep the energy on set high all the time. Even if it's a drama, I try to keep the energy like positive at least.
Yeah.
And even when it's like a downtime, they're doing a setup or something like that, I go hang out and talk to the actors, go hang out and talk to the background, just to sort of like keep the energy going and keep people like stimulated. Yeah. Because it's hard for an actor, like you said, to go up and down like that. Like you do a scene, it's a dramatic scene, then it's like, yeah, we're going to go get the turnaround. And it's like, okay, I got to sit down for an hour and do nothing.
I know. Yeah. It's crazy. And you know, this one was really interesting, this feature, because I wrote such an intense character. Like I basically wrote my experience of grief for everyone to like watch. Just the drinking, taking home a bartender, weeping, ruining her, you know what I mean? Just like, and there were moments where I was weeping, full on weeping. And then knowing that something didn't go right. So then I'm like back in my director producer brain, or like hearing somebody move or something, you know, and just like, it was something. It was really one of those experiences that you're like, why did I, man.
What keeps you going? Why do you keep doing movies? What is your motivation?
Oh my God. Well, I mean, so one of the phrases that I always say to people is, we're just spinning on a rock in the middle of infinity next to a ball of fire. And I really do believe, you know, human beings, sapiens, right? We create these stories in our mind. I mean, that's basically how we got into this mess with, you know, governments and money and religion and all sorts of ridiculous bullshit that we just thought up. And then had a group of other sapiens who were like, yeah, I'll believe that too. Let's do that. That sounds fun. Mm-hmm. And so I think that as a filmmaker and just as a human being, it's fascinating to me that like we are creating lives and stories in the midst of all these other created stories, right? To like, to hold a mirror up and say, especially like right now in the world with government and religion and money and the whole financial thing and the haves and the have nots. And you know, these are all constructs of the human mind, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of fascinating as a filmmaker that we get to do that. So just love people. I love stories. And I think movies are, they're like the only real tool that we have other than the personal experience to change hearts and minds. You know, I mean, that's what art does. And I think movies more than anything, my God, think about Netflix, Hulu, everything that we have during this pandemic and all of the things that people are watching that they wouldn't have had time to watch that they, you know, I don't know. I just, that's what keeps me going. I love stories. I love people. I love to tell real stories about real people.
Yeah.
And fantastical stories about real people.
Yeah. Stories is probably the first art form. It'll probably definitely be the last. It's and film is how we do it in our time.
What would you say, you know, based off your experience, was probably one of the biggest obstacles that you faced that actually you questioned if what you're doing is right, if jumping from acting to directing is right for you? What was that?
Oh God. It's interesting. They're all really like smaller specific things. I never questioned whether I was going to be a director or not. I think I was too naive to do that, you know, because I just wanted to do it.
It's a good naivete.
Yeah. I just wanted to do it. So I didn't really question that. And I wasn't precious about it. I was very precious about being an actor. And when things didn't work out with that, it was like heartbreaking. But with the directing, it was just something I loved to do so much. But there was one story, where I did a book trailer for a woman. She was like a spiritual guru or something. I don't know. She just seemed like a mean lady to me. But And I was really new to the game, and she was pushing me for an edit. And at that point, I was still editing all my own stuff, like on Final Cut, and just trying to, you know, do all this stuff and have friends do sound mixes and things for me. And so I showed her something where the sound wasn't mixed. And she called my boss and basically like asked for money back and asked for reshoots and all this stuff. And then in an email to me, she said, "I just don't think this is probably what you're supposed to be doing."
Ooh.
Wow. That's,
And I,
what kind of spiritual guru was that?
Yeah. What's happening there?
I don't know. It was, that could have been really heartbreaking to me, but I called my mentor who had taught the course, Miles Watkins, and I told him the whole story, and he just, you know, he said, "She's a horrible human being, even more colorful, but like, right. Don't listen to that, yeah. Nelly, like don't." Mm-hmm. And I figured it all out. And at the end of the day, I go back and I think about that. I was having such trouble editing her. And I think it was because I just found her to be so, like, it was all negative. It was all like from a negative perspective, and I couldn't find a way in to the edit. And she didn't like the way she was coming off through my eyes. And that's kind of another thing that filmmakers have to understand. Like, this is what you got to work with. So right. It's like, not your face, obviously, but like what's in your head. And, right. And I don't know, that could have been very hurtful and crippling. And it certainly was in the moment, but it didn't, it just made me like cry on the phone to my dad and say, "Hey, if I have to figure out a way to pay back the company and this budget, will you help me?"
Right.
So,
that is a fantastic story. I mean, that is what you overcame there. I mean, you could have easily just, you know, folded and went back home. And, you know, it's very encouraging for our listeners to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, people are going to tell you a ton of stuff about what you make. Mm-hmm. Don't listen to them, because at the end of the day, you know, I was saying this to somebody recently, like if someone comes to you and they're like, "God, you should have made this character this, or you should have had this be the story." And they're like all these things that just would make the project that you make different. Then just say, "Thanks so much. Why don't you go make that movie? I made a different movie."
Right.
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 I made a different film. That's not actually the film I made. And that's very different than someone you trust saying, "God, you know, in that scene, there's this line that bumps me. Tell me what," you know, that's a constructive thing. But to talk about it should have been this character, it should have been that character, it should have been set here or whatever, and be like, "Great. Why don't you write that? Raise the money, go out and shoot it. And then, you know, that'll be your movie, not my movie."
Yeah. Certain notes, I feel like navigating notes is one of the biggest things in this industry, I feel. Because you're going to get some stupid notes like that, where it's like, you know, I made a cheetah. I didn't make a cheetah with stripes. You're trying to add stripes to my cheetah. What are you doing?
Exactly. Exactly. Sorry. What are you, my character, guys.
Yeah. I made a cheetah. What are you doing?
Cheetahs have spots. Not sure if you know that.
Yeah. Like, you're just changing everything. Funny. And also, I think another important thing too about notes is who it's coming from. Because 100%. Sometimes you go to a person who makes action movies, or they do things where everything's fast paced, and they do a lot of, and you made, you know, a simple character study drama, and they want to go, "Oh, needs more action." It's like, okay, wrong person. So it's important that you don't take those notes to heart. And I'm glad you did not, because we still have Nell Tier working.
Thank God, right?
And Nell, so how important is it to have that support group behind you, like that group of mentors to guide you?
Oh my God, it's hugely important. Yeah. I am the biggest fan of having mentors. And as soon as you get to a point in any part of your life where you feel like you can genuinely give good advice about something and be helpful to someone, then start getting mentees, because it is Like there's just nothing better to have so many perspectives around you and to develop these relationships with other artists. And I mean, I laugh on my sets. I say I adopt everyone, right. And I kind of do, but I mean, so Julia and I, my work wife, my DP, she and I have now done somewhere close to 50 projects together.
50? 50? 50.
Wow. And, wow. And she's my partner. You know, we bounce ideas off of each other. We get inspired by the ideas that we bring and the problems and the way we solve things. And, so yes, having mentors, my God, I mean, I have so many mentors. I'm so grateful. I'm so lucky, but I also have a lot of people that I mentor. And nice. It feeds me in a way that I, you know, it's like the best thing in the world.
I'm a little interested in your transition from Texas to New York and that experience and that jump, because that's a pretty brave jump, right? A pretty brave jump for you to go from, because New York can be a little harsh, so...
You hear Al's accent.
I know. I get it.
I lived in Houston for a couple of years. So you know, they're a little bit more kinder, a little bit more softer, gentle, very loving. But
you know what?
Go to New York.
Oh my God, Al.
It could be a little shocking,
Brooklyn.
Overwhelming.
Yeah. So
I'm just curious. I just curious.
I'd been there. I think it was actually my first trip I ever took when I was a little girl. I was like 3, and my mom and dad said that like my brother was holding on to my mom's leg and my father was chasing me through the streets of New York and Manhattan. Cause I was like, nice. Oh my God, this is amazing. This is amazing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I had a school trip to New York when I was 15, my freshman year. And it was because of theater. So I saw the original cast of Rent. I saw Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk. Like amazing. And I just remember walking into NYU and just going, this is where I'm going to school here. New York is my home. I know it's my home. So I had this excitement about it. And as I went through my high school career, we got to time for college. And I said to my dad, I think I'm going to audition for Juilliard. And he was so against it. And I was like,
really?
Why? And he's like, I want you to get a degree. I want you to have a degree from a university.
Now your mom was a actress, but your dad was, he wasn't.
My dad is everything. My dad was in school for like a decade. He has the equivalent of a master's in like chemistry and biology. He's a dental school dropout. He has his MBA. I mean, he's a consultant and a professor, or he was a consultant. Now he's a professor. He was a farmer for a couple of years. I mean, he's done everything.
Wow.
Right?
Okay.
But he was just adamant about that
right.
degree thing. And so I said, fine. I'll go to NYU, but I'm only applying to NYU. And if I don't get into NYU, then I'm just going to move to New York.
Right. You got to deal with it.
And this is not like dad could just write the check for New York. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like me like gambling here. And he's right. like, God damn it, Nell. Just, he's like, well, you have to at least do early admission. And I was like, okay, but if I don't get in. So you can imagine what I was like to have as a child.
I was just thinking. I was just thinking that I have 3 daughters, so I'm like, wow.
Get ready, Al.
I'm nervous right now.
Get ready. But anyway, so you have to understand. I got to New York, and it was like coming to America for me. I just was so happy. Like people were mean. I would bless people. I would say bless you if you sneezed on the subway, down the train.
What are you doing?
I love this because I see people like this in New York, and I'm just like, she's definitely so excited about being in New York right now. I just want to give her a hug.
Exactly. And I think that's how New York felt about me because I never had anything but wonderful. I was adopted by like every landlady. Yeah. Every like laundromat owner, you know.
And it's funny because you start finding people with the same energy that you're bringing, right?
And the other thing is, you know, when New Yorkers love you, they love you.
Yeah. They're loyal as hell. Yeah.
They're loyal to you.
And I love, oh my God, I love New York. Mm-hmm. I was there for a decade, you know, I had my life there. And
nice.
Yeah. I was such a New Yorker. I spent the last 3 years that I was there in Astoria, Queens. And,
nice.
Oh my God. I mean, I never got over how people would yell at each other, like 6 feet apart from each other. Right. Like my freshman year, I called my dad because I'd seen this fight between two taxi drivers. And I mean, they were screaming horrible things like F your mother and that, like at each other. Right. And I called my dad and I was like, Dad, they just scream at each other like the most horrible things. And then they walk away.
Yeah. They're venting.
And my dad was like, I know, baby. Isn't that amazing? One of them be dead already. I was like, I know. But yeah, that was one of those things where I was like, wow, Dad, this is crazy.
I'm here. This is the place I'm at right now.
And they yell at each other and then walk away.
But do you think it made you a stronger person and a better overall person?
New York did wonders for me. I started bartending. I bartended my way through NYU. And after, I would go to work right after class. I'd like have dinner and I'd go to work and I'd work till 4 a.m. and then I'd wake up and I'd go to dance, you know? So it was just like, I had this stamina. I built this stamina. So yes. So New York taught me my capacity for work. Like it taught me to show up for myself in a way that is just unbelievable.
All right, Nell, it is story time.
Oh, okay.
So I spring this on you. I didn't want you to plan anything, but I want you to sort of like, what is your craziest on-set experience? You've been on a lot of sets, I feel.
Oh, yeah. God, guys. Well, yeah. So, actually, just happened. Okay. Just happened. Like,
nice.
A couple days ago. And we had the most insane shooting weekend I have ever had in my 120 productions. Okay, so first things first, my key grip rear-ends somebody and his car is undrivable. We had a COVID scare, which turned out to be nothing, but it was a potential person in our crew, and the crew was tiny, like 10 of us, crew who may have been exposed. Anyway, everything was fine, like that was all worked out. That was the second day. On that second day, the man who rented us the trailer, he flipped out and basically locked us out. We had left the grip truck and everything there on the final day.
Oh, shit.
It was crazy. It was a crazy day. I have never been kicked off a location. And I tried to work with him and all of that, but he was demanding all of this money, which made no sense. Like, this is not that, we don't have that budget. Like, this is a lot of favors. These are a lot of like coming together. It's her first film. He was just, man. And there was literally nothing I could do.
Yeah.
And I felt so horrible because there were like 3 shots we still needed and we weren't going to be there the whole day. Anyway, we had like a bunch of like in the car shooting and everything. So it all worked out and we were able to do it, but it was just like, it was one of those shoots that you just go, oh my God, the gods are so unhappy with us. What did we do? I've never been locked out of a location.
That's insane. That's insane.
That must have been like super stressful as well, right? Like for the whole
totally
team.
Stressful. Yeah. But the other thing is like, what can you do?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing that I've learned over the last decade is like, what can you do ever, guys? I hope that was fun enough. Like, I feel like I needed to say like a dragon showed up or something. Like, oh my God, we were in the middle of this shot and then a dragon landed and
he bit off his face.
Walked off.
No. We that's perfectly fine. I mean, on set experiences, those experiences where it's like, I don't know what what do I do here? There's nothing I could do. I remember I was shooting a web series. This is 2013. And I had two actors on set. They're supposed to be there. First day, the actor had laryngitis. She couldn't come.
Oh,
and
no,
she's talking the whole day. So she could not, it wouldn't make sense for her to come.
Right.
So she couldn't come. The reshoot, we had the reshoot. Another actress in the same scene or in the same shoot day, her dad collapses and has a stroke.
Oh my God.
Like a seizure. He hits his head and like rushed to the hospital. Like when I'm going to, like she's going to get picked up to shoot. And she's like, my dad just collapsed. And then the next day, an actor just didn't show up. So we had three reshoots that just did not work. And the fourth day was the final day where we finally got everybody together. And then even on that day, someone had to leave early. So we just like sort of pieced together the thing.
It was just one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a weird, weird situation. So I know exactly what you mean.
You know what I mean though, Stephen? You're like, what did I do?
But I don't know what to do about this. And then I feel bad because I'm like, her dad just collapsed and had a seizure. It's way more important than my freaking web series I'm shooting.
Yes, of course. And that's the other thing. You have to have perspective on this stuff, right? It's like,
right. But still know. That like you got jazzed up for like weeks and weeks and then you shoot.
And you raised all this happens. Money and these favors and these people. And then it's
like, oh, God. This guy collapses and you're like, you're sort of your emotions are in two places. Like, oh man, I feel so. She's like my childhood friend too. Oh. So I'm like, I knew this guy growing up. He's fine now. Everything's fine.
Yeah,
it's just like he's fine. But in that moment, it was like, oh my God. But I can't shoot. Oh my God. Like, so it's like sort of weird. Bad, you feel bad for that.
No, but, dude, I always think of There's No Business Like Show Business, that song, you know?
Yeah,
like, Like, no, we're the weirdest people in the world because, like, the world could be falling down and we'll be like, just get the last shot. This tidal wave's coming. Can you get the shot?
Hold on.
Wait.
In connecting, in getting all these projects and doing all these projects, what was your process of staying connected with people and how did you get all these projects? Like you must have networked or how did that come about?
So it's really interesting. I think, I've been very lucky in my life. Like if we go back to the beginning of this, my mom was in this industry. So there were relationships there, not many at the end of it, but some. And then, friends of mine, my best friend in the world, two actually, I met in seventh grade in Pershing at Pershing Middle School. So we've traveled this life together. And then so many friends from high school who are still artists and still succeeding in a way that is unbelievable. Then obviously that expands out to Tish, you know, and then some of those people from high school ended up going to USC or Berkeley or Juilliard, or wherever. And then so it just becomes like this huge network of people. Yeah. And like I said, the thing I think that is one of the things that I think is really important and what is important to me as a filmmaker are my relationships. And so I love and I foster my relationships and I'm always there to help people with theirs. And I think that's been a huge thing is that I will bend over backwards for people to help them get their stuff out. Like for instance, on this last film, I did it for Gas Money. You know what I mean? So like there's very, like I'm that type of person. I think those relationships are kind of forged in fire when you support each other that way. But yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of how I've done it is by helping and not being afraid to ask for help as well.
Nice. If you had all the financing and all the green lights, what is your dream project?
So I've been working on a script. I'm not going to say what it is, but it's based on a song and I've been working on it. I wrote it with a good friend of mine for years. I guess we finished it like 3 or 4 years ago. And we are in communication with everybody we need to be in communication about, but that would be my dream project. And it's a road movie. It is very special. And I think it will happen. But it might be 2 years away, but I'll let you guys know if it does.
Nice.
But basically it's just.
So you're currently working on your dream project.
I am.
Nice.
Yes. Right on.
I am currently working on it. Yes, I have written it with my good friend. We are in touch with the people that we need to be in touch with about it. And as soon as this COVID stuff lifts up and I can start really going after the funds that we need, then it's going to be a done deal.
Nice. Well, congratulations. Yes, please. Congratulations. That's awesome. Yeah.
That is exciting. That is super exciting.
I'm really excited.
Yeah, I see it. I feel the passion, man.
My eyes just like went two different directions. Yeah, super crazy.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And just another question is, your writing, when you write, do you prefer to write in a collaborative manner or by yourself?
I prefer to write by myself, but I have collaborated on two projects and now a third project. I love other people's creativity. So as long as I can sort of like, when I have these characters, they live in my head like they're actual beings. You know, so sometimes it's very hard for if somebody's like, well, what if they did this? And I'm like, well, that's not what they would do.
That's not what they would do, stupid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right. What are you joking?
No, it's very, So in that way, like, it's better to start. For instance, the Dream Project, I got 60 pages in and I realized I needed a male perspective. Because it's sort of like an outlaw Romeo and Juliet story. And I reached out to my friend Ford, who is just brilliant. And he came in at that point and we kind of went back through and we threaded his voice into the parts that I had already written. And then we picked scenes that we would write. And then we came back together and we gave each other notes on those scenes and we built this thing out. So
nice.
Like that was a really fun way to work. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. This is the last question.
Last one.
I love it, guys.
This is it. This is the question.
Oh, God.
You ready for this one? Go ahead, Steven.
Okay. So 40 to 50 years from now, you're an old lady. You're looking back on your career. What makes you most proud?
My relationships with people that I've worked with.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good because I feel like that means you've perspective. Yeah. You know, some people say win an Oscar. It's like, all right, cool. Yeah, it's good. But
I don't know. I mean, it'll be fun because if I won something and I've won some little things and they always give you like a nice little bump or whatever. But at the end of the day, you still go back out on set and you have to make more stuff. And, you know,
exactly. Well,
The cool thing is
that your friends can give you an award, right? So, you know.
I could just ask everyone and be like, guys, so it's been 30 years. I've never won anything. I'm just wondering, can y'all create something and give it?
There you go. There you go. No, but I mean.
I really do hope I just die on set. I mean, I hope that I'm not like looking back on my career. I hope that when I die, I'm like fully in it.
Just looking like, at dailies.
It's going to be, and then I'm out.
That's the way to go. So what's the name of your company? Where can we find you? All those things.
Yes. So my company is not really prevalent right now other than just to be the entity through which I do everything, but it's Tearlit, T-E-A-R-E-L-I-T. And it was kind of the idea of my sister and I, at some point I'm going to get her to step out of her real job and just make movies with me all the time.
Right.
Hannah, my little sister.
Shout out to Hannah.
Saying it to everyone.
Get it together, Hannah.
Yeah.
And then you can find me everywhere. Nell Tear, N-E-L-L-T-E-A-R-E. I think there's only one other Nell Tear, but her name is actually Fenella and she lives in the Isle of Man. So
you're good.
I think you're good. You've got a good chance of locating me.
You got your Instagrams and your Twitters. Do you do all that?
Nell Tear on Instagram and Facebook, and then Tear_Nell on Twitter.
Gotcha.
And you find me on LinkedIn. And my website is www.nelltear.com. It's just When I start saying this, it just makes me feel like a crazy megalomaniac. Meltier.
Meltier.
Ubiquitous.
That's good. That's good. And I thank you so much for doing this. You are obviously a very prolific filmmaker. You're a hustler beyond. And I appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
Steven, thank you for asking me. And Al, like, what a wonderful, wonderful way to spend this day with you guys.
Thank you. You are super kind. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
If you like this episode and are listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review or check us out on Instagram at Once Upon a Film Industry. Thanks for listening, guys.